Blog Talk Radio.
Hot info. everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people might have heard about the Nevada revolt, you know, by the Bernie people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this article doesn't really go into it as much as I'd like to, but explains how the people are getting screwed by Bernie. Bernie's people are getting terribly screwed over, and all of the primaries and the things.
Well, you can thank the Democratic Party for that. The way they run their party is disgraceful. It's run to keep people out.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And
the Democratic Party,
because they're running
it anything but Democratic.
I was going to say, because they're running it that way, this might destroy them.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's
the way it has to be. Maybe that's the way it has to be.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to grab all these party hacks by the hair and you know, pull them out into the street. That's what they're doing now. Barbara Boxer and Feinstein and all these crazy ass Hillary superdelegates. Senator Barbara Boxer, a veteran of Democratic politics, says she never saw anything quite like this before.
Yeah.
Loud cursing, shouting, obscene gestures, and vile insults, including crude comments about the female anatomy. It was all on display over the weekend as supporters of Bernie Sanders turned the Nevada State Democratic Convention into chaos.
I was not able to stop these people.
Because it's a lot faster than walking.
Sorry,
for president.
Okay.
Have you found a running mate?
Maybe that's a little audio on that piece.
No, it said something different.
Oh. I was not able to stop these people for doing what they did, Boxer, a Hillary Clinton supporter, told CNN. Apparently they've done it before. This group of about 100 were very vocal, and I can't describe it. Disrespectful doesn't even explain it. It was worse than that. Well, they think cheating's all right, so.
Oh, yeah, cheating is
Boxer is hardly the lone Clinton supporter who experienced such harassment on the campaign trail. Several top Democrats told CNN publicly and privately that the energy and the enthusiasm of Sanders supporters has at times descended into incendiary attacks that threaten to tear apart efforts to unite Democrats against Donald Trump. Several female senators told CNN the attacks have been misogynistic. What's more, many Democrats fear that if Sanders does not rein in his supporters, the same ugly scene that occurred in Las Vegas last week could replicate itself in the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. He should get things under control, Boxer said of Sanders, saying it was worse than the vitriol during the Bush-Gore 2000 recount. We're in a race that is very critical. We have to be united. He knows that. I have, in fact, called him a couple of times, left a couple of messages. I'm hopeful he can get control of this. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California said, I do, when asked if Sanders should drop out of the race after voting concludes on June 7th, giving Clinton a chance to pivot to the general election ahead of the July convention. I think it would be most regretful if there becomes a schism, Feinstein says. That's what Donald Trump should want, a schism in our party. It's a responsibility, particularly of Senator Sanders, to see that doesn't happen. Well, I don't think I think the Clinton supporters have worked to make it happen.
Yes, of course.
They have.
They deliberately ignored 60 of the of 60. They cut them right out of the count in Nevada for 60 Bernie Sanders delegates, okay? Delegates, all right? And gave the and split the delegates to 50-50 or something.
But it shouldn't have been that way.
But he actually won the debate, you know, won the damn thing.
The primary.
Yeah, and she's been doing this all along. Okay, these damn Democratic
Superdelegates and all registrars of voters have sold out.
And even when he wins the primary or the caucus, they wind up rigging the freaking delegate vote. Okay,
mm-hmm.
It's really sick. It's really sick. She's lost 19 out of I don't know how many primaries and caucuses already, and
he's ahead in the winning.
He's ahead in the winnings. They say, oh, we got 3 million more votes. That's not true. She did not get that. That is not true. All right? She is way behind Bernie in that. They're just not counting them. All right? They're not counting those tallied for Bernie. They keep saying, oh, she's 3 million ahead. That's not true at all. All right? And it's been proven true or not true.
Just go up a little bit, please. On Tuesday, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said he had a long conversation with Sanders to lay out what happened in Nevada. He said that he condemns that. I'm confident he does, Reid told reporters. This is a test of leadership. Reid declined to comment when asked if he was worried that Sanders' backers could upend the national convention this summer. But Sanders' statement Tuesday was defiant, saying that the Democratic Party has a choice. It can open its doors and welcome into the party his backers or maintain its status quo. At the Nevada convention, the Democratic leadership used its power to prevent a fair and transparent process from taking place, Sanders said, adding that there have been zero reports of violence during his massive rallies across the country. Asked to respond Tuesday afternoon, Reid was angry, telling CNN it's a silly statement that someone else prepared for him. Bernie should say something, not have some silly statement, Reid said. Bernie is better than that. I'm surprised by his statement. I thought he was going to do something different. Well, what is he supposed to do? Just hand everything to her? She's cheated and lied her way to where she is.
Just lay it down. See, my biggest fear of Bernie back when he began was he was letting her walk all over him,
mm-hmm.
right? And she was starting to take. She was cheating in the polls. She was cheating everywhere. You know, finally, his you know, he got. You know, got enough nerve and enough backbone, you know, to finally stand up to her, all right, and stop having him her kick him in the groin, you know, on all these debates and on public speaking. So he just started to do it to her, and she didn't like it very much, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, stop being such a nasty boy, you know. And it was really ridiculous. Still is. Now, finally. Bernie's backers, Bernie's supporters got more balls than Bernie, and they're going out there and bashing, you know, chairs and threatening to break up the system, all right, that should have been broken up 100 years ago. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, this two-party system has been a tyranny to this country, a dictatorship, and should be banned, completely banned, all right, broken up. Piecemeal. I mean, the Democrats and the Republicans after this election are bull crap. There's nothing left to them. All right? And the entire...
Well,
and all the election laws are going to change. They're all going to change.
They're
going to
try to hold on. No,
they're
going to
try, but they're not going to make it. They're not going to make it. Between the Trump supporters and the Sanders supporters, Jesus. You know,
yeah, the Republicans are trying to get together and not fund Trump enough. So
I know.
Money.
They want to kick him out. So there's going to be a huge battles in both conventions, and the major parties are going to lose. They're going to lose so badly it won't even be fun.
Yeah. I mean, not that I'm supporting Trump. I just don't like what's happening to him either.
No, I mean, you know, he is the guy who was nominated.
In their so sacred process.
Yeah, exactly. And all of a sudden, they go, oh, no, we can't have him. You know, it's like when the entire country says, go ahead, get him, take
him. The only one who has any money is Hillary, has a ton of money is Hillary Clinton, because they want to fix the election.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
In the interview with CNN, Lane called on Sanders to publicly apologize. Yeah, I've not received an apology. Lang said, I don't know who Lang is here. She's the registrar there in the state of.
Well, he didn't do anything.
Whatever. No, I've not received anything in the campaign. I haven't seen anything that says they should stop, and it's going to continue unless people are made to feel like this isn't okay. This isn't behavior we should have. Yeah, they said they put her phone number out up on Facebook or something.
Huh?
Social media. She got over 1,000 phone calls in one day. On Tuesday, the Nevada Department Public Party, the Democratic Party, sent a formal complaint to the Democratic National Committee, saying Sanders backers and campaign officials actively incited disruption and violence at the convention. Well, Sanders campaign manager Jeff Weaver said on CNN Tuesday that people who are supporting the senator should act in a civil way. Well, Trey should obviously fight with its content, and by fight, I mean contest it. If there is a convention, they should be there. They should present their case, and then they should let the votes fall where they may, Weaver said, and adding, there should be no threats of violence. But he also took aim at Democratic leaders in Nevada, saying the state party has a lot of problems. It is run poorly, and the system is the silver state is in the silver state is done very undemocratically and is dysfunctional.
Uh-huh.
There seems to be an unwillingness on the party of the Nevada Democratic Party to bring in all of the new people that Bernie Sanders has brought into the process, Weaver said. And on Monday evening, Harry Reid, who has ruled the Nevada State Party for years, blamed Sanders backers for inciting the bedlam that ensued at the convention. I've been dealing with Nevada State conventions for 50 years. To say I was disappointed was an understatement, Reid told CNN. But I hold his people accountable, and I'm sure if Bernie found out about it, he would not accept that happened there. Not accept what happened there.
Sanders warning that he plans to take his campaign to the July convention in Philadelphia, even if he's trailing Clinton in pouch delegates, Democrats are growing increasingly fearful that what happened in Nevada could be repeated, just as the party is struggling to unite after a spirited primary. Senator Majority Whip Dick Durbin of Illinois said, of course he's concerned that the same tactics would be replicated in Philadelphia. We saw what happened at the Trump rallies, which broke into violence, people punching one another. I don't want to see that happen in the Democratic Party, Durbin said in an interview in the Capitol. I call on Bernie to say to his supporters to be sensible. Don't engage in any violence. And he said that. He said, don't engage in violence. Top Democrats say that it is incumbent on Sanders to bring his supporters into the fold or risk electing Trump. He can't tell people how to vote. They support him, but if he's not the nominee, they might vote for someone else.
Yeah.
Or not vote at all, because the person that the Democratic Party is supporting does not have the values that Bernie Sanders does.
In fact, you've got to remember that there's a Bernie or bust movement out there right now of Bernie supporters.
Uh-huh.
They will not vote if Bernie does not get the nomination.
Yeah,
they will not vote for a Democrat. They will not vote for Hillary.
No, why would they?
They will not.
She represents all she is Republican light.
Yeah.
So why would anybody?
They would rather.
Why would a Democrat?
Yeah,
vote
they
for
would
her?
Rather see Trump beat. You know who will beat? Who would beat Hillary? Okay, all the polls show that Trump could be beat by Bernie, not by Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And Hillary's got so much negative baggage on her that they think that they could actually lose by a landslide to Trump, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because people just will say, fuck her. Oh, forget her. I don't want her.
I mean, they may not like Trump very much, but they dislike.
But they may not even vote. Or they may just vote for Trump just to say, oh, this I can't vote for Hillary, you know what I mean? And I would even do that if it came to worst, you know, if the worst came to worst.
I think people feel that way about each of them, Hillary and Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that there are certain people that can't stand him either, so those people won't vote. They won't vote either.
So it'll be a loss again of millions and millions of voters that won't vote. And, of course, unfortunately, Democrats will lose, but they did it to themselves, and they won't regain, you know, unless they clean out all the old established idiots. And Hillary is finally in prison, you know. But Senator added, in this campaign, Sanders has gotten a lot of people engaged. He should be able to go through the primaries, and he's committed to do. And Hillary did that in 08. And Shaheen said, hopefully once the nomination is done, then he will endorse the nominee.
I can't
yeah,
picture
right.
that.
Garrett, if he wins, I wonder if she would endorse him.
No.
Yeah. But that'd be great. I'd like to see that happen. She Maybe forced it, to be honest. Let's see if I can get that. I don't think that.
What is that?
It's actually a thing.
We're looking at a video. Let's look at this.
Yeah.
Alpine, could Sanders revolt?
Now playing. Where is it playing?
Right there.
Oh, here it is. No, it's not.
Yes.
I think I just did.
No, you didn't.
This one's over.
That's the wrong way,
and
sir.
And then 3 seconds.
Supported by Hotels.com.
Okay.
See if this could, if we can get this.
Really what we're seeing here is tension between the Democratic Party leadership and the Sanders campaign that we really have not seen in this primary season so far. The fears that the tactics employed by Bernie Sanders supporters by shouting, heckling, screaming, and in some cases, some reports of, as you mentioned, throwing of chairs, has caused a lot of fears among the party leadership that this could spill into the convention in Philadelphia in July. Now, Bernie Sanders' campaign says that they were not responsible for that, but CNN has obtained audio of a top Bernie Sanders official, Joan Cato, speaking to Bernie Sanders supporters before this convention on Saturday, urging them to really take a firm line against the party leadership.
You should not leave. I'm going to repeat that. Unless you are told by somebody from the campaign, i.e. probably me or David, that you can leave, you should not leave. I don't care if the chair is up there herself or whoever the chair is and whoever becomes the chair, you should not leave.
Now, one person who did speak at that convention was Barbara Boxer, the California Democratic senator on behalf of Hillary Clinton's campaign. There were loud cursing, there were vile comments, there were references to the female anatomy, really crude gestures that she said. I got a chance to talk to her about it. She said to say that they were disrespectful does not really do justice to what happened
to her.
She really has not experienced anything like this before. Other Democratic senators have told me something similar, something they worry about. California Democrat Dianne Feinstein even said that she thinks that Bernie Sanders should drop out after June 7th when voting concludes. Now, the Democratic Party, the National Convention, has responded to this. I'll read you a statement from what they are saying right now, Brooke. They said, "We are deeply concerned about the troubling details laid out in the letter by the Nevada Democratic Party. We'll be reaching out to the leadership of both of our campaigns to ask them to stand with the Democratic Party in denouncing and taking steps to prevent the type of behavior on display over the weekend in Las Vegas."
That's cool.
You can politely steal the election?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That doesn't matter, I guess. Huh?
Stephen King, the master of suspense.
Trump,
I enjoy keeping people up at night.
My analysis shows your stories are actually about human connection, even love.
They just throw these damn things at you, and you don't get a chance to block them out. What I was trying to say is expect violence, expect chaos at the convention.
Mm-hmm.
You can really expect that because, I'll tell you, it's going to be fun in the sun.
Well, he got more votes.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
And his people are willing to fight for their rights. And the Hillary people just think they can
steal your rights.
Steal
and lie your rights.
Bastards. All right.
Well, similar to her emails.
I once had years ago, back in 2004, was the last time I had any respect for Barbara Boxer.
Yeah.
And, after the concession by Kerry.
Oh, that was.
She called together the Democratic Senate, Democrats in the Senate, to demand a recount, of the votes, and that was the last time she ever stood up for anything that I can think of, and after that she wound up becoming a Hillary buddy, and then now she's now the karma is paying her back. Ha-ha! So, her and Feinstein there, the two sisters of the Yaya sorority, the Hillary Rodham Clinton sorority. All right, One more thing. Rules to make more workers eligible for overtime.
Yeah, they've talked a lot about that on the news.
It's been on the news today a lot, but I think it's important that we mark that, note that with us. Because each program that we do is archived, okay, and each program is recorded and archived in our system. And this is history. This is stuff that should be remembered, all right, marking significant moments in law.
Well, it just shows that money is how money has become devalued, Leo.
I'm just trying to say that we do this for historical reference, okay? And this is a significant bill that's being, done.
Well, it just shows how money is devalued, that you have to earn $47,000. You know, it used to be much less than that. So you're earning $47,000. You can't even live on it.
Well,
that's what's happening. These people are working hard. They're not getting time and a half.
Yeah, well, anybody under $47,000 winds up getting overtime. Anybody over salaried employees over $47,000, right, or $50,000, right?
No, 47.
It would raise the threshold to $50,440. All right. However, the law firms.
The final version.
Law firms and worker advocacy groups say the final version lowers the proposed threshold slightly to $47,000. Right. Still, about 5 million salaried workers are expected to be newly eligible for overtime, and the rule, which likely would take effect in 2 or 3 months, also is expected to include a mechanism to raise the threshold annually. Isn't that good?
Well, I think it is.
That's good.
But I think it's very sad you have to earn that much,
They've done that for years as salaried employees.
Oh, yeah. They make you a supervisor.
Yeah. It represents a significant step forward in the effort to boost wages for working people, says Ross Eisenbry, Vice President of Liberal Economic Policy Institute. Many businesses will convert salaried employees to hourly employees and ask them to punch a clock and track their hours, according to the National Federation of Independent Business. Yet even those who remain on salary will have to monitor their hours and get paid time and a half for logging more than 40.
They'll probably be told they can't earn, they can't work more than 40 hours.
Right. Well,
and they'll be deducted or whatever, with a docked or whatever they'll do.
Entry-level management positions are going to disappear, and those employees will fall back into hourly jobs. The large number of small businesses are expected to instruct their employees to work no more than 40 hours a week because they can't absorb the added costs, says Dan Broach, NFIB Senior Manager of Regulatory Policy. To make up the productivity gap, some firms will likely hire part-time workers, he says. Others are expected to cut the base pay of effective employees to account for the extra money they'll make in overtime. Jeez, God. All right. So, imagine that. They're going to cut people's pay. So they But Richard Alfred, head of Seafarth Shaw's wage and hour practice, says many larger companies will pay the additional overtime cost or bump up employees to the new threshold to avoid shelling out the overtime cash. Labor has estimated about 1.2 million Americans will actually receive increased wages through overtime or higher base salary.
Oh, good.
Well, some people are getting ahead. I don't know if a lot of people are getting ahead on it, but, they always find ways to kick you in the pants.
Yeah.
Well, layoffs notices are sent to 113 judicial branch employees, including staff from the Meriden, Connecticut Superior Staff Court.
Well, they had judicial layoffs, that's true.
And we spoke about this last week with Larry Dorman. And the judicial state, just all the areas.
A lot of layoffs.
All the different departments. I mean, they were talking about 3,000 layoffs or something. But the judicial branch Monday in Connecticut approved a positional...
Provided a positional breakdown of layoff notices sent out earlier this month. Almost half of the layoff notices, 53, were to judicial marshals, including 15 from the New Haven Superior Court, which handles the more serious cases from Meriden Superior Court. The most recent 113 notices were sent out May 5th, bringing the branch's total to 239, after the judicial branch also laid off 126 employees in April. The branch also said more layoffs could come as it continues to review changes to budget for fiscal 2016, which begins July 1st. Locally, Meriden will lose two marshals, while the Waterbury Superior Court and Middletown Superior Court will each lose one. The Meriden and Middletown courts will each lose a probation officer, while Waterbury's will lose an intake assessment and referral specialist. New Haven Court, meanwhile, will lose four juvenile probation officers and an intake assessment and referral specialist. So there are a lot of
lawmakers.
More to come, too, they say.
Oh, yeah. $48 million. $48.8 million in cuts in the judicial branch. And lawmakers cut a total of $821 million as part of a budget fix to close the $560 million deficit in next year's budget. And the judicial branch layoffs are separate from the ones that Malloy, who said the state needed to reduce its workforce by 2,500 positions, is currently doing within executive branch agencies.
Hmm. Wow.
So anyway,
lots of cuts.
Yeah.
Every few weeks there seems to be another round.
Well, in case you wonder, how much more CEOs earn than average workers? You ever wonder that? Well,
no.
Here it is.
It's too upsetting. I've read these facts before.
It's no surprise that the people running the nation's largest corporations take home hefty paychecks.
Mm-hmm.
But possibly more eye-opening is the ever-widening gap between what CEOs earn and what their workers are paid. Last year, the average chief executive of a company listed by the S&P 500 made $12.4 million, or 335 times the $36,875 paid to average workers. The ratio stood at 101 to 1, 107 to 1 in 1990.
Honey, did you call the insurance company?
Not yet.
Lord.
I'm folding laundry. Can you?
No, cleaning the windows.
Well, the living room's a disaster.
You should see the bathroom.
Sorry, sorry, I hate these pop-ups. Horrible.
Sorry about that. It makes it very difficult.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Well, how
but
about
anyway,
the real USA long-term unemployed? Let's find out.
Yeah, that's an actual, that's kind of a long video, but it's worth watching some of it. It's about 20 minutes. But this gets into some nitty-gritty interesting stuff. Tells the reality
Welcome.
Of the situation.
As 2015 begins, we bring you another special edition of The Real USA. On today's show, we'll hear stories of inequality in the United States, as the gap between who's rich and who's poor continues to grow in this country. I'm Alexandra Hall. As you watch the program, I invite you to share your comments via our Twitter, at Telesur English. One of the groups most affected by the enduring economic recession is the long-term unemployed. Let's look back at a story brought to us by correspondent Mary McCarthy that showed the longer you're unemployed, the less attractive you become to employers.
Ed Turner has been saying the same thing for the past 4.5 years.
My name is Ed Turner,
Ed, how you
and
doing?
I'm looking for work.
He's at a job fair in the Denver suburbs, but after such a long stretch without a permanent job in his field, he doesn't have high hopes.
You get told no so often that you get, it's kind of a, well, I go there because I know I'm going to hear no.
Financially, it's been devastating for his family.
We have had to declare bankruptcy. We lost our home.
And I was a manager, quality control manager.
And the cost is emotional, too.
Over time, you become depressed, and some feeling of self-worth is wrapped up in that.
This city resource center helps match the unemployed with employers.
This truly is our basic core level service, and it'll take you 5 to 10 minutes to create your profile.
But officials here admit that in a tight job market, older applicants are at a disadvantage.
We do see that older worker population coming in and finding a little more difficulty than you would at 25 or 35 or even 45.
Long months of unemployment lead many people to seek positions way below their skill level.
At this point, I'm a banquet server and a bartender doing that. I also have two master's degrees and I'm licensed as a banker. But in this economy, I'm really glad to make tips.
Employment counselors say their programs aim to help the long-term unemployed rebuild their self-confidence.
What we focus on the folks that are long-term unemployed is, let's look at your skills first. Are they up to date with what you need? Is there a current industry certificate that maybe you could go to some short-term training that would help you become more employable? We have internal workshops just on the basic job readiness stuff, right, getting back into the workforce. Does your resume look like it needs to? Do you have a cover letter? Do you have a social media presence?
Ed Turner, meanwhile, keeps checking the job postings every day.
It looks like it's the same as it was yesterday. There's no new ones.
Here in Colorado and in many places across America, middle-class jobs with benefits remain hard to find, and it's a reality that doesn't look likely to change anytime soon. Mary McCarthy for Telesur, Denver.
Approximately 20% of New Yorkers are currently living in poverty, and now some residents are turning towards a different economic model to earn a living. Let's look back at reporting from our correspondent William Denslow in 2014.
House cleaning is often a thankless task, but for Maria Aguila and Rosa Palikibai, life is getting a lot better than it used to be.
There is a big difference between working elsewhere and working as part of this cooperative. Out on the street, I would charge $10 an hour as compared to here, where I can make anywhere between $15 to $20, and that is a big difference.
Before joining the Apple Eco Cleaning Cooperative, finding regular work in New York was tough going. And for Rosa, being a single mum made it even tougher. Both Maria and Rosa have been working at the co-op for over a year, and they say it's not just the wages that help. Because it's a worker-owned initiative, all employees have a say in the business, and that means learning new skills. And with these skills brings confidence. Maria says she couldn't use a computer before she joined, but now she helps run the company's finances. A skill that's helping her at home, too.
Now with the cooperative, I'm learning finances, so I handle my own finances now. I surpassed myself. The change was different, and now I can spend more time with my kids.
He's pledged over $1 million in funding worker cooperatives. And as the gap between the rich and poor grows in America, some economists say schemes like these will continue to generate interest.
As long as we see, you know, these abject economic failures in the private economy, there's going to be more openness to new ways of organizing business.
If worker cooperatives like this continue to grow in New York, economists like Parrott say they could have an influence on more traditional businesses too. With more competition, the hope for many would be that employers would be forced to up wages and improve conditions for existing workers.
While experts say schemes like a worker cooperative won't address the unemployment problem overnight, both economists and politicians will be looking closely at initiatives like these to see if they can bring a lasting relief to some of those most in need. William Denslow, Telesur, New York.
The economic crisis that began years ago created significant property depreciation, and the housing market in Richmond, California still has many residents with a mortgage on high alert. But an initiative called Eminent Domain could protect homeowners from losing out on their investment. Our next story came from correspondent Maria Juliana Brick.
We got issues here.
Richmond, California, nearly half the homes are worth much less than their mortgage. In order to avoid abandonment of homes, more foreclosures, urban blight, and loss of tax revenue, the city has proposed a controversial strategy of buying back these underwater mortgages at fair market value using eminent domain.
Eminent domain has been used as a tool by which municipalities would claim land
for a greater public good. The real issue is how this housing crisis has devastated neighborhoods. Your eyes do not deceive you. You can drive through some of our neighborhoods, you can drive through neighborhoods throughout California and certainly the United States, and you see what it's done to neighborhoods. And it's incredibly, extremely unfortunate.
The result of this crisis, we are seeing some communities that are ghost towns. The middle class is being squeezed here in Northern California and some other high-cost parts of the country. At the height of the crisis, it was really exemplified in part by gigantically large foreclosure numbers. So we were looking at about 1 million foreclosures nationally in 2006, about 1.1, 1.2 in 2007, 2 million in 2008, 3 million or so in 2009. We have an imbalance in our housing system and not enough controls in place to protect people. Investors are swooping in and buying up foreclosed on properties by the hundreds and by the thousands. Rents are skyrocketing across the Bay Area. In some of our, many of our other communities, rural communities, communities of color, values are still down. And that.
There's something else I wanted to talk about. Why Walmart can't afford to give its workers 50% pay increase.
Oh, really? They're going to try to justify that?
Yeah, well, they do. They try to. And it says, something here. This is from Fortune magazine. The world's largest retailer is under fire for its low wages, but the numbers show it can easily pay more without tanking its stock. Fortune magazine says, when a Walmart executive boasted at a Goldman Sachs investor conference in September that 475,000 of the company's U.S. stores associates make more than $25,000, meaning that a large portion of its 1.4 workers in the U.S. make less, a long simmering debate about the company's wages boiled over last week. And a large protest outside a California Walmart store led to 50 arrests.
Wow.
Using the anger pay scale, a salary information site, estimate that Walmart CEO Mike Duke's 2012 pay of $23.2 million was 1,034 times more than the company's average worker. And Walmart has called that figure inflated. But so, how much should Walmart
pay its employees?
Employees. To tackle the tricky question, I crunched a bunch of numbers and concluded this. Walmart's workers should get a 50% raise. And get this, the company wouldn't even have to disappoint Wall Street to pull it off. I'll explain the math in detail. He says, and there are a number of ways to answer the question of what Walmart should pay its employees. And one possibility is this, the lowest wage that Walmart can get away with paying. That is probably the way many employers do it, but it's far from the best economic answer. Better paid employees are likely to work harder and stick around longer. If employees made more, they would have more to spend at Walmart. And many critics argue that because Walmart made $17 billion in profits last year, they can afford to pay more and even has an obligation to do so. And that's silly, too. Public companies have to make enough money to satisfy shareholders or else their stocks tank and executives end up getting canned. Well, I gave up with that, with what I feel is a better, more scientific way to determine the answer. Then I called a couple of really, I can't move this page now. I called a couple of really smart economists to get it peer-reviewed, and who teaches at this guy, I can't pronounce his name.
Sindel?
Malinathan.
Sindel Malinathan.
Who teaches at MIT. and received the MacArthur Genius Grant for his work in behavioral economics a few years ago.
I see why he's a genius, because when he was little, like three, he had to know how to pronounce his name.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
That started him on the road.
It's probably Sheldon. And genius grant for his work. Okay. He says companies have more discretion in setting wages than they let on. And really, the question is not whether this is possible, but why some companies do it this way, says
Melinda.
Walmart didn't respond to the request for comment.
I'll bet. So without further ado, here's my methodology. Start with Walmart sales, then subtract what it has to pay the suppliers that make all the stuff on its shelves. Last quarter, that number was $28.7 billion. What remains is Walmart's gross profit. Walmart, like all companies, has to split that between three groups: bondholders, stockholders, and employees. How much should go to each? Bondholders are easy. They've agreed in advance to an interest rate. Last quarter, Walmart's interest payments were $553 million. That leaves us with $28.2 billion, based on last quarter of $112.8 billion a year. How much to pay stockholders is a little bit tricky, but you can figure it out by looking at the market. Here's where my math comes in. Stock market valuations and return on equity, ROE, tend to go hand in hand. ROE is the measure of how much income a company makes compared to the company's net worth, which is also sometimes called shareholders' equity. Charles Lee, a finance professor at Stanford, my second peer reviewer, has done a lot of research that shows investors are willing to pay more for companies that can produce higher returns on shareholders' equity. But you can also use Lee's research to figure out just what returns Walmart's investors are looking for. The average return on investment of retailers on the S&P 500 is 16.95%. Their shares trade at price-to-book ratio of 2.9. Walmart's price-to-book ratio is 3.5, is 20% higher than the group, which means that investors, based on Walmart's current $79 share price, are expecting it to produce higher than average return on investment. How much higher? Lee says the relationship is not linear or one for one. Let's call it 18%. That's based on Walmart's current stock price. Investors are signaling that they are looking for a return of 20%. Remember, that's not the money that Wall Street actually pays out to investors. Most of the money is reinvested in its business. But it does pay out some in forms of dividends. And Walmart has a higher dividend yield than the average retailer on the S&P, 2.4% versus 1.3%. Adjust that for Walmart's valuation versus other retailers, and that means 4.6% of the return shareholders are looking for comes from the giant retailer's oversized dividend. That means the return of investment has to satisfy investors after dividends is 15.4%. It's a little complicated.
But anyway, they're not doing too badly as Walmart.
I guess not. I guess they can.
And they could definitely afford to give these guys a raise. You know, get them,
they just don't want to.
Yeah, you know, they just don't want to. They want to keep the cash and give their CEO a huge, huge raise.
And themselves on the board.
Of course. So, and, you know, people tend to forget that Hillary used to be on the board of Walmart.
Yeah.
That's right. She was a board of directors of Walmart.
So she approved all this stuff.
Yeah.
And got paid while she was there.
Exactly.
Remember, guess what state Walmart started in?
Arkansas. Yep. Yep, yep. So having the First Lady of Arkansas on your board was probably an interesting thing. Oh, I don't know. They got away with it. She's been getting away with crap like that her whole life.
Yep.
So, just amazing. Sanders' camp slams Debbie Wasserman Schultz for throwing shade on his campaign.
Yeah. Remember, she's the head of the Democratic Party.
National Committee.
Yeah. National Committee, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, but still similar to that. She gets there by... You can
well,
only get there by...
she's from Florida, right, where they had all those crooked voters.
Yeah, but prior to her, it was Howard Dean for years. Remember?
Yeah.
Remember Howard? Yeah.
The one who screamed?
I just remember.
From Vermont.
He's the guy who betrayed the left.
Yep.
They betrayed all the anti-war guys. He wound up getting Bush for another 4 years.
All orchestrated by these parties.
Well,
it's your turn. No, it's your turn. Oh, it's my turn.
We'll end the politics with this one. I'd like to excite everybody about the burning fuels of GMOs in Hungary. They burned everything at Monsanto in Hungary.
That's a nice thought.
Yeah. Well. The insults are being hurled inside the Democratic Party as part of the fallout from last Saturday's Nevada convention. The latest contrary roiling the Democratic Party shows no sign of abating Wednesday, as Bernie Sanders' campaign put the onus of the rift-splitting debate on Debbie Wasserman Schultz's failed leadership, accusing her of throwing shade on the Vermont senator from the beginning.
Huh.
The chaos that ensued Saturday in Nevada at its state convention over what some perceived as unfair delegate allocation erupted into the national scene and has lingered beyond two additional Democratic primaries, exposing the Democratic Party for infighting as the Republican Party takes steps to unify itself behind its presumptive presidential nominee. Well, Sanders' campaign fired back at Wasserman Schultz on Wednesday morning after the Democratic National Committee chairwoman panned the campaign's anything but acceptable response to reports of violence and threats from Sanders supporters at the Nevada Democratic Convention over the weekend. Jeff Weaver, Sanders' campaign manager, pointedly accused Wasserman Schultz of undermining the Sanders campaign forum and the get-go and called into question her leadership. He categorically condemns any kind of a threat that went on. Absolutely unacceptable, we were told CNN on Wednesday. Before accusing Wasserman Schultz of throwing shade on Sanders' campaign since the very beginning, citing a limited debate schedule that featured weekend debates, the campaign's revoked access to its voter data and joined fundraising agreements with Hillary Clinton's campaign that Weaver said takes money away from the state parties and goes to the DNC. Look, I gotta say, it's not the DNC, Weaver added. By and large, people at the DNC have been very good to us. Debbie Wasserman Schultz really is the exception. The fracas over the weekend escalated on Tuesday after Nevada Democratic Party lodged a formal complaint to co-chairs and members of the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee over the conduct of Sanders supporters. All right. The state party warned that the very dangerous atmosphere that ended in chaos and physical threats to fellow Democrats is indicative of what could happen in Philadelphia, a notion Hillary campaign has pushed back on. So expect some real trouble in the campaign.
Oh, I do?
I would hope so.
Mm-hmm.
Unless Bernie wins outright, you know, before then. Debbie Wasserman Schultz has really been a divider and not really provided the kind of leadership that the Democrat Party needs. Weaver said he speaks with high-ranking Democrats at the DNC with frequency, but suggests there isn't consensus in terms of her tactics, calling the revoked voter data access last year a unilateral decision from Wasserman Schultz. Believe me, there was tremendous pressure inside the party structure for her to relent, and Weaver said, I don't really know what her motivation is, but it's been clear there's a pattern of conduct from the beginning of this campaign that has been hostile to Bernie Sanders and his supporters, and she's really become a divisive figure in the party. Yep. And Wasserman defends herself and says that she's fair, but everybody knows Wasserman is a Hillary wonk. And she's doing everything she can, because Hillary probably promised her a big job if she got, you know, right?
Oh, I wouldn't blame someone for wanting a good job, don't we all?
Yeah, but get on it. Hey, just so we can end on a positive note, I don't know
what to think about
Americans, this. America pretends there are only two genders. But did you know that the Navajo honor four genders?
Well, let's find out.
There's a little video here that talks about it, so I wanted people to hear about this one. So, the Indians were way ahead of everybody back then. Let's hope I can get this out better. Come on, it's supposed to be a video that goes with this. Come on.
Oh, so slow.
It takes forever to come up with these things.
Yeah, they have all these add-ons.
Everything
else on these sites. It's become very difficult.
To navigate any of these sites anymore. They're just so heavily monetized that they don't even allow you to navigate. Now, this one here.
Here it is.
All right. I thought there's a video. Americans have been pretty uptight when it comes to gender roles for a long time, but now that it hasn't always been that case, Navajos have long recognized four different gender identities rather than two, and those who don't fall into traditional puritanical Eurocentric notions of gender identity are revered rather than ostracized or even killed, as are the case of Fred Martinez, the youngest victim of hate crime ever, and the subject of a 2009 PVM. Okay. So anyway, let's listen to this. It's only 2 minutes.
They've always been medicine men and everything else.
Yeah.
It's hard to lose something that you love so much.
Fred's brief life is so interesting because he had a high degree of self-acceptance about who he was.
Didn't want a label. Wanted to wake up in the morning and say, who am I going to be today?
The masculine and feminine together are sometimes reflected so completely in the body of one person, it's as if they have two spirits.
Half woman, half man, they call it nut play. They call it, oh, so cool, I'm a nut player.
Fred was poor, person of color, lived in a remote area. You do the math.
In the life of this place we call America, there is nothing more traditional than two spirit people.
We were getting married here long before it was a glimmer in the eye of Stonewall.
He really wasn't breaking rules. He was simply trying to be himself, and bless him for it.
Masculine and feminine are oftentimes reflected so completely in the body of one person, it's as if they have two spirits. The two-spirit organizer, Richard Laudfortune, said, the documentary draws attention to what the Navajos called Nalahi, which is the confluence of the masculine and feminine within in each person, sometimes in resulting in what many consider two-spirited people. Those born with one biological sex but who identify with another gender identity. Fred Martinez was Nalahi, born male but who identified as female. As Two Spirit points out in its opening, in another time, Martinez would have been honored. Instead, he was murdered in 2001 at the age of 16, all due to his two-spirited nature and gender identity. Navajo scholars included in the documentary, Wesley Thomas, states, in Navajo teaching, in the old traditional world, there were four basic genders, women are the first gender because Navajo is a matrilineal society. Men are the second gender. And the third gender is Nadalihi, who is born as a male person but functions in the role of a girl in early childhood and the role of a woman in adulthood. And it's just the opposite for the fourth gender, Thomas adds, where they were born biologically female but function in the role of a boy in early childhood and matured into a man and conducts their life in that gender identity. In Western culture, when they say a girl, there's an automatic assumption that the girl is female. Or when they see a boy, they never pause to think that that boy may be female, Thomas points out. Mainstream America, however, would like clear-cut Ken and Barbie illusion maintained, complete with missing genitalia, to keep us all from thinking of those naughty parts. But if you do get American thinking of those hoo-hoos, muffins and whatnots, it better be sexual, preferably to sell products. Don't give them any of the breastfeeding in public business and never ever make them uncomfortable enough to wonder if you're living a gender identity that if they feel conflicts with your unmentionables. Otherwise, as Martin has found out, they just may make you pay with your life, proving once again just how much mainstream America still learned from the indigenous people. That's very sad. Yeah. Well, they got a point there. I never really thought about it.
Yeah. Anyway,
that way.
They're ahead of their time spiritually. They really were. Or are. But I want to, we're going to leave it tonight. It's the end of the show. And we're out of time. But we want to thank everybody who joined us. And we want to say,
have a good evening, folks. And keep.
Oh, and don't forget, if you can check it out, they just burned out all these Monsanto, every general genetically modified cornfield in Hungary. All right, has been burned.
Wow.
They don't want any of those.
I don't blame
they don't want
them.
Any of that in their.
Because it doesn't produce a good yield as they found. And it's another Monsanto hoax.
Exactly, and it's a form of poison.
Yeah.
You know, it is. It's because it's the insecticide that's in it, the modified within it. So anyway, all right. Well, good night, everybody. Have a good week. You might want to join me tomorrow night. I think I'm going to be doing a special on Thursday night. So good night, everybody.